Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Emma Powell. How are you, Emma?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. Bradley Gerrard. How are you, Bradley?
I'm good, John. Thank you.
Excellent. Ian Smith. How are you, mate?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad.
Good.
Not too bad at all. Okay, another manic week, as seems to be the norm these days. Lots of results this week, kind of winding down now, but this week marks the peak of the late results rush. Lots going on in news, and Emma, you've written the cover feature this week, which we're going to talk about, which is about M&A, which has been a big theme of 2015. Before we do that, let's perhaps start with the news at large this week in 7 days. Bradley, what's been going on in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I guess some interesting data that we covered in 7 days was the Euro jobs data. Unemployment fell to a three-year low of 10.7% in November, which beat forecasts of 10.8%. And that's quite interesting given what's going on as we speak now. Mario Draghi has just dropped the deposit rate from -0.2% to -0.3%, which effectively means if you're a bank in Europe and you park money with the ECB, it's costing you 0.03%.
Wow.
Or 0.3%.
Doesn't sound very attractive.
It doesn't sound very attractive, and that's the point, I guess. Draghi wants banks to lend to people and businesses in the economy to restart inflation. And he's also, just as we were coming down here, I had a look, he's extended the quantitative easing programme to at least March 2017. The deadline was September next year, from memory. But he's extended that and done a few other things as well. He wants some inflation in the Eurozone, so that's quite an interesting thing, obviously, coming to the end of the year and thinking of next year. Will we see a bit more return to inflation? Well, Mario Draghi is certainly trying his best.
Yeah, well, he needs to stoke up some demand.
So it does, each round of QE does seem to have less of an impact on the market, so it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, the European equities have done very well off the back of the quantitative easing, kind of free money, easy money that's been going to markets there. But you wonder how much impact this round, latest round, is going to have.
Yeah, it's certainly what we saw from US QE, that the impact was slightly less every time. So, yes, good luck, Mr. Draghi.
Yep, absolutely.
Good luck there. Okay, what else we've got going on?
I think another interesting story. Obviously, the banks are stocks that our readers and listeners of this podcast are quite keen on. And all of them, although albeit two, kind of limped across the line, but they all passed the Bank of England's stress tests. RBS and Standard Chartered were the weakest runners, so to speak, but they're doing enough to kind of please the Bank of England.
Yeah. So, Ian, you would have looked at this in a bit of detail this week, being a banking correspondent. And we didn't give it a massive amount of coverage in the magazine, but we did update RBS tip.
Yes, we have three tips at the moment that this affects: RBS, Barclays and Lloyds. As Bradley said, they all came through. RBS scraped over the line, to use your expression. Because of steps it was already taking to improve its capital, it was not required to submit a revised capital plan following the stress test. Now, as Bradley points out, in 7 days, the stress test was based on an emerging markets crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So Lloyds, for example, did very well. That's perhaps not surprising, considering Lloyds is very exposed to the domestic market. So what they didn't do was model a crisis on a UK property crash, for example. So those banks that are especially exposed to emerging markets, such as Standard Chartered, which was the other bank that would have failed were it not for the capital raising that it is also doing, that also struggled a little bit. But I suppose the point that I get into in the tip update a bit is that actually for RBS, for example, the capital side of things has been improving for a while with the disposal of its North American bank Citizens. It is making progress there. There are other problems for the banks. But we should view this as it's kind of a reasonably historic thing in that the Bank of England now thinks the risks in the financial sector have moved to the emerging markets and that the banking industry is rather well capitalised. So you can see it as a kind of a bit of a watershed moment. But I suppose if they do a slightly different kind of stress test next year, it may show up different weaknesses.
Okay, so that all sounds like good news. As you mentioned, we've got a number of banks on buy tips. How does this result affect our views on the sector as a whole?
Well, we've got Barclays and RBS that we have on buy tips. We have tipped them as kind of on restructure plays, that they are continuing to reduce their risk-weighted assets, to improve their kind of capital base. So this very much feeds into what we've been looking at. So RBS is continuing to do exactly what we wanted it to do, albeit that buy tip is still underperforming. So what we need to come back at the banks, I suppose, is more of the kind of income. The focus is now on the top line. So we're going to have to see progress of these straightened banking operations. And the same for Barclays too. That had that initial strength under Anthony Jenkins. It was doing what we wanted it to do. Barclays has also fallen back a little bit on the markets, and there's question marks among investors as to the direction of that bank, especially its investment banking operations. And today Barclays sold off its Italian retail branch network, but has retained its corporate banking and investment banking operations in Italy. So we're seeing this continuing disposal of non-core assets, which is helping the banks on capital, which is crucially helping them on dividends. And that's something that's important when we look at banks coming back as those old income players of old. And Lloyds is a company that we have on a buy tip in expectation that it will have the capital headroom to start paying higher dividends again. So we think they might be coming back.
Okay, we might be waiting a bit longer for RBS to pay a dividend though.
We might be waiting.
But hopefully not quite so long for the shares to get back to where we tip them.
Exactly right.
Okay. Banks. What else we got going on, Bradley?
Well, I guess on the theme of income, one thing I mentioned very quickly is BHP Billiton. It's obviously a very big stock that a lot of our readers will be keen followers of. And our commodities reporter, Mark Robinson, he's kind of drawn a bit of attention to this ongoing situation that BHP has in Brazil. The Brazilian government is effectively looking to sue BHP and
for the
Vale.
Dam collapse.
Yeah, for the dam collapse in Brazil. The event itself is also very tragic, and there's a lot of work needs to be done to sort of help repair the community. But from an investor's perspective, I suppose the one thing really that needs to be watched, which Mark talks about in the IC View section, is the fact that the shares now carry a 9.8% dividend yield. And management has said that it's confident it can continue to keep paying its dividend in the same way, which it has done. Yeah, exactly. But the shares are down about a fifth in the past month. It's quite a large fall. And actually, I think it's kind of gone not under the radar, but a fall of that magnitude is big. And the dividend yield that high now is something to be mindful of.
Yeah, value trap springs to mind, potentially.
Potentially so.
Yeah, I would be ultra cautious with any play on the mining sector at the moment, possibly even more so than it would be on the oil and gas sector. Mm. Interesting story. Yeah, Emma, you've got something in the news section this week, social care.
Right. Yeah.
Tell us about this one.
The kind of care in the home providers, the main ones would be Mighty and Mears, and that sector's really struggling at the moment, and it's not because budgets are being cut. They're actually increasing, but they're not increasing as much as needed, i.e. with the aging population. So I was actually speaking to the CEO of Mears, and he was telling me about a lot of the kind of administration being very paper-based still, which was quite shocking to me, that the way like the rounds are divvied up and things like that for care workers, and this is for big contractors like Mears, that actually say the care worker's being paid £8, Mears has a few pounds on top of that for profit, and the rest is just going on this administration. It seems incredibly wasteful. And I think he was getting quite frustrated about the fact that the NHS and social services, obviously, their budgets are separate and their departments are separate, and it makes it very difficult, I think, for people doing the job to actually know about what the information is from the doctor to what they need to do as a care worker. And actually, they've just won very recently contracts with Milton Keynes, and earlier this year with Torbay and South Devon local authorities, where they've actually done this joined up kind of NHS local authority, social services, actually working together with Mears to deliver it. But I think his impression was that a few years ago, when they actually took on care work at the request of local authorities, he had the impression that it would be a lot faster, this kind of integrating of services, and it's still really lacking at the moment.
Yeah, big government IT projects, they're notoriously slow to get moving, and notoriously prone to ending in absolute disaster as well. But I mean, I would have thought it's, Mears is in pole position to perhaps drive some of that change that's needed.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he says he's urging some of the local authorities to actually take this approach, because it's a lot easier if you can share information, and just councils being quite slow to change isn't exactly a surprise to anybody, is it?
See, this is quite an interesting story. It ties in with a feature you wrote a couple of weeks back, Carve Up, about the role of outsourcing in the delivery of public services.
Well, I mentioned both Mighty and Mears in that respect, and the fact that delivering care in the home is not very profitable at the moment.
No.
Or efficient for the people, you have to serve.
We got a bit of abuse as a result of that feature,
yes,
on the basis that we were seen as advocating that the kind of sell-off of public services and the profiteering from local government. But it sounds like the private outsourcing industry could actually add a lot of value to the way public services are delivered. And we felt it was a bit unfair, the flack we got.
I tried to get across the point that this was from an investment perspective, and I was not advocating the outsourcing, nor was I criticising it. I was stating the investment cases. But yes,
I did
get some flack via Twitter for that. So
indeed, which was fun. But no, I mean, as I said, I'm in the same position. I think, you know, where outsourcing is done well in the public sector, it can definitely improve the way.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of pitfalls, but at the same time, yeah, it can deliver a good service at the same time. So.
Mm. Well, we can expect some more flack for saying that.
Here we go.
Black Friday. Do we really want to talk about Black Friday? Give Black Friday any more airtime than it's already had, which is far too much.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Yeah,
it's still a good story, a good read, a good overview by Theron and Harriet. But yeah, listeners, go and have a read on the website or in the magazine. Otherwise, I guess a little tidbit in 7 days, which is interesting. The kind of quarterly rebalancing of the FTSE is upon us. Actually, WM Morrison has fallen out of the FTSE 100. It's
not
been there quite a long time, I think. But obviously, the recent kind of troubles.
I believe, actually, I was just reading today that G4S has also fallen out.
Yeah, there is an outsourcer that perhaps gives the rest of them a bad name, or has given the rest of them a bad name in the past.
Yeah. No, G4S is mentioned in the piece, and then apparently, I think Meggitt as well fell out. And an interesting promotion in FTSE 100 is Worldpay, which only actually IPO'd quite recently. It's not in even the FTSE 250 yet, but it's performed so well since its IPO, it's going straight into the FTSE 100. So that's an interesting move as well.
And again, that kind of reflects a trend that we talked about in a feature, God, it's quite some time ago now, but about the changing methods of payment.
And, yeah, exactly. And Theron wrote that, at the end of cash.
I played into
that.
Bradley. The reason I thought relevant to jump in there was that De La Rue came out and said that its banknote production, it was going to reduce its production, which Emma covers that company, but that very much feeds into the same trend.
Cutting their production lines in half.
Mm. That's a sell tip.
It's
gone the right way.
It's gone the right way for
us.
Saying sell, but not the right way for people invested in it.
No. Do you think they're, they're going to have to change their business model somewhat?
Well, they are. They're going much more into kind of passports. They already produce passports, but security and identity products. I mean, to be fair, actually, I met with the CEO a while back now, and he was very aware of the fact that the security and identity was where the future was.
Mm. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Given this uncertain world that we live in, which has become a little bit more uncertain in the last couple of days.
Yeah.
While we're talking about companies, I mean, let's talk about some results. You know, what I said was we're gonna pick our favourite, and I don't get to do that because I don't write them. Emma, let's start with you. So, what was the result that caught your eye this week?
Probably Pennon, which owns Viridor, obviously Waste Management Viridor, and also South West Water. So I always see Pennon as the best water stock. They're really good for kind of reliable income, the water stocks. But with Pennon, it's been held back in the past by Viridor, which has obviously kind of felt the decline of landfill and things like that, but they've been dialing down their landfill contracts, and they've been setting up these energy recovery facilities, and I think it was something like it was over 100% revenue growth for Viridor during the first half, which is great for them. So
yeah.
We've also got them on a buy tip, so that really reaffirms that.
How's that doing?
Yeah.
It's
up on our buy tip.
Lovely. And delivering a big fat yield as well, like you say.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That was a lot of the kind of reason behind the tip.
Yeah. And by contrast, Severn Trent was the other water company that you would have covered this week. Oh, the shares look like they're doing all right, but we're less keen on these, aren't we?
To be fair, all the water companies are pretty good, and they all deliver a pretty good dividend yield, but the water companies have their business plans approved for the next 5 years from until 2020, and Ofwat kind of Severn Trent got the least favourable kind of outcome from that, which meant they had to cut their dividend at the time, which obviously United Utilities nor Pennon did they have to do that. So that's kind of, we would see that as the weaker one, Severn Trent.
Okay. Bradley, Lots of results from you this week. What was your pick of the bunch?
It was a busy one. I guess I'd be remiss not to mention Green King, really, given the shares were up about 13%, I think, on the day.
That's spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
On results day, that's highly unusual.
It is, yeah. I mean, it was a good set of numbers. I mean, it's important to remember that the headline numbers include its recent acquisition of Spirit Pubco. So Spirit's obviously, that business is doing very well, and Green King's acquired it, and it seems like a shrewd move. There was underlying growth of Green King's sort of own estate as well, so that's promising, and maybe that's what helped drive the shares, that, you know, the growth wasn't just coming from the acquisition, but there's still organic movement there as well. And I guess it's an interesting stock. I actually decided to move it to a buy because I think there's enough kind of still going on there that makes it interesting. So the group's going to be rationalising the number of brands. They have about 20 different pub brands between the combined group does. They want to halve that. They want to really focus on their kind of real, what they see as their real growth brands. And they introduced a lot of initiatives to try and gain revenue and profit before 5 p.m. So the whole sort of breakfast and food during the day thing, which has really become important for the pub groups to be, you know, not just have a pint in the evening. They want you there.
Have a pint in the morning as well.
In the morning as well. But that's a really important trend, I think, is that pub groups really need to make sure they are, you know, earning money at all times of the day. And it seems like Green King's been able to start doing that much better.
Absolutely. Sweat the estate.
Exactly.
Sweat the estate. And an old favourite of mine had some good results this week, Cranswick.
Do you know what? I was just toying whether to mention that as well.
Go on.
It was a good result. Again, acquisition comes into it. The Cranswick, historically, obviously very focused, or pretty much entirely focused on pork products, and last year bought Benson Park, which is a poultry producer. That's worked out very well. From speaking to a few people, because I'm actually writing a feature which does mention Cranswick, I won't sort of elaborate much more, because you can read it in a couple of weeks' time. But Cranswick, to sort of go into chicken or poultry, is very good. It's sort of serving a lot more of the food-to-go sector in the UK, which is growing thanks to that. And a key thing for Cranswick, and again, a reason why it went on a buy, again, I put it on a buy from a hold, was just because the potential for Cranswick to grow its overseas sales is huge. The export sales to the Far East rose 17%. And at the moment, all it's really doing is selling into places like China.
And that's pork again.
This is pork, really. Selling into places like China, what the company calls fifth quarter products, so things that the Western...
The bits we won't eat.
The bits basically. We won't eat, yeah. So they're just doing that, and yet the amount they're exporting is really, really growing fast. So if there is demand in the Far East for more westernized style products like ham, bacon, sausages, Cranswick is very well placed to serve that demand.
Okay. There's a disgusting ad I keep seeing on television, which is for some travel company, and they're advertising it by showing a man eating a snacks chicken foot somewhere in China. It's absolutely foul. Maybe there's a bit of chicken they can ship as well we won't eat.
Yeah, maybe there's some chicken fifth quarters as well.
Absolutely. Okay, but Cranswick is a great company. I used to like that before I became a vegetarian.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a very good stock. A good decision, it seems, to buy Benson Park. It's on the sort of subject, I suppose, of merger masters.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a minute. We're two companies there who've had successful acquisitions. Ian. Before we move on to the cover feature, let's quickly get your pick of the results this week. So one good, one bad.
One good, one bad. Okay, good. Brewin Dolphin, which upped his dividend, and the reason that the Brewin Dolphin one is interesting is that the wealth managers have been doing very well, but Brewin Dolphin has really suffered since the summer, and I think it dawned on everyone that revenues of wealth managers, especially those with commission based revenue as part of their fee income, will suffer because of the market drawdowns. But Brewin Dolphin, you know, ended up for these results running it on an earnings basis at a discount to the rest of the wealth managers, but with a bigger dividend yield once it had upped its dividend. So no surprise that the share price went up on results day, and again up today, another 6% the last time I checked. So that was good for them, and the way that they're changing that business and moving more towards discretionary fund management, which is where a lot of wealth managers are going, because it's more consistent fee revenue.
And it's lower cost to actually provide.
They say that the margins are not so different between the two of them, but with discretionary, the asset's quite sticky. You tend to keep it. And also, they pay out on more of a kind of regular fee income. But that we'll have to see more of that as it goes on. At the moment, a lot of the wealth managers have a mix, but we, in some ways, favour the discretionary wealth managers.
As investments?
Yeah, as investments.
Yeah.
And then the bad result was Aberdeen, which just continues to be, in some ways, part of the same story, this flight from emerging markets. The 3 months to September was a worse quarter for outflows from the asset class since the financial crisis. So really bad period of investors getting spooked, primarily in Asian equities, and getting out. And that's really hurting Aberdeen. It also seems to be hurting, like other managers, from sovereign wealth funds in oil-dependent economies. Sovereign wealth funds kind of taking money out to support domestic economies. That was also mentioned by Martin Gilbert on that call. So it's a very interesting time for Aberdeen. The FT ran a story saying that the CEO was courting potential acquirers for the business. This was robustly rejected by Mr. Gilbert on the morning results call. They say they're very much not interested in being bought out. But yeah, the question for Aberdeen is just how much lower can it go?
Yeah, so we're not advocating buying at the moment, but we're not advocating selling either.
We're not. We've copped out slightly. I mean, it would be a big contrarian emerging markets call to buy back into Aberdeen. There's lots of good long-term reasons to be cheerful about the business, but it's still very much suffering from investor sentiment that does not look to be shifting. So it's a brave person to say we think that's going to come back strongly.
Yeah, I mean, my own view is that, you know, is that emerging markets will, in the long term, still be a good place to have some exposure. And I'm sure Aberdeen will eventually benefit from that, but yeah, we could be waiting quite a while.
Yeah, they say it's a cyclical downturn in emerging markets and that it will come back. And not only that, they're diversifying the business into other areas of alternatives, such as private equity. They've done acquisitions to improve their distribution, such as the Parmenion acquisition that we've discussed on this podcast before.
So this is a robo advisor, isn't it?
Well, yeah, what it does is allows IFAs to outsource their investment management and provides kind of risk graded portfolios. So that's somewhere where the managers, fund managers, really trying to make sure that they've got a good distribution channel into this retail market.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Interesting,
I think, stuff. Aberdeen was also, there was another story I think this week that it might be in the running for a big US bond house called Roger Capital. So yeah, as Ian says, I mean, it's working hard to diversify its business, but it will be interesting to see how that pans out.
Okay. Let's move on from results, and there are lots of them in this week's magazine. As we've heard, a couple of those companies are on the acquisition trail. In fact, all of them seem to be on the acquisition trail somewhere along the line. This year has been an absolute monster of a year for M&A, which I talk about in my editorial this week. There have been, to date this year, $4.6 trillion worth of deals. And that's as much as the previous year as a whole. So we've got a month to go, and the record has already been surpassed from 2007. Most of those deals, 40%, are over $10 billion in value. So lots of mega deals going on. And mega deals scare the living daylights out of us. Hard to do, hard to bash big companies together. Certainly lots of evidence to suggest they can be value destructive. But we're looking at it from a slightly different angle, aren't we, Emma?
Yes, well, I mean, obviously, just day to day, we hear so much about acquisitions every single day from all sorts of companies. But I guess it kind of got me thinking, well, how do you actually, as an investor, try and value whether an acquisition is going to be good or bad for a company, whether it's going to be earnings accretive or destroy shareholder value? And as you mentioned, obviously, the bigger deals can be a disaster. And there's so many disaster stories. But there are also a lot of companies that are doing it well. And so, obviously, I kind of wanted to look at companies that are doing more kind of bolt-on acquisitions and growing that way, and just try and look at, you know, some of the ways that I guess you can spot whether a acquisition is going to be good or bad for a company.
So a bolt-on deal we would tend to view as something that's a lot smaller than the company that's buying it. What sort of other characteristics might we expect from a so-called bolt-on?
From a bolt-on, so it could be, it should be very complementary to the acquirer. So Charles Taylor is an example of a company that kind of follows this strategy where they look to acquire companies that are obviously in the insurance sector, where they can cross-sell their services between clients. Lakehouse is another one, where they buy very similar. They actually service the social housing sector, another outsourcer. But they basically kind of make acquisitions to increase their kind of coverage over the country. And again, they kind of cross sell. So that's another one.
So like infilling, basically. So
infilling
with regions that they don't cover or products that they don't have.
Yeah, yeah, because they've got this ready-made client base, which might be like, well, you know, can we'd like to get this service off you, which we currently get off someone else, and it's easier to just get it off the same person. So there's that aspect of bolt-ons.
And I guess that brings scale benefits as well. So
yeah, exactly.
Kind of all duplicated costs can be taken out. And it's much easier
cost synergies is another one.
Yeah, yeah.
Although that shouldn't be, I don't think that should be your motivation for making an acquisition.
No, and often that's what some of the bigger deals will justify themselves on. So, you know,
that's not
huge companies bashing themselves together and talking about billions of dollars or pounds worth of cost savings. And that does often seem to be the only rationale for some of these very large deals.
Yeah.
But we're thinking more strategically.
Yes, definitely more strategically. You know, for a lot of companies, I know DS Smith is one of Daniel Alberto's companies, is they've kind of gone further into Europe to kind of, you know, once they've saturated the UK market to, and I guess a lot of companies do this, to sell their services abroad. And I guess they get more diversified that way also. For Rentokil, they're actually like an ideal kind of example of bolt-on acquisition growth strategy, because they're going a lot more into kind of Latin America and a lot more of the emerging markets to, well, I guess, do pest control and those kinds of things, because they see that as a high growth area. So they're definitely motivated by moving into new geographies.
Is there a risk when a company does that, that they go into a geography that they don't fully understand?
There's definitely a risk. And another thing that you've got to make sure is where companies go into a new geography because they think, we're going to follow our customers, you've definitely got to make sure that actually you have a sustainable customer base over there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not just, you know, a company's not just looking at maybe one or two large clients they have and then thinking we'll pick up more. You've really got to know that there's a large client base there that it's going to sustain growth.
Okay. So, but I guess what you want to see as well is management of the acquiring business who've kind of done this before.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Practitioners of the small bolt-on deal, know how to do the due diligence, know what they're looking for. So management must be very important in all this.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, again, this is why we try to give a lot of examples of people doing it right.
Mm.
Track record, obviously, is something that you're going to look at. People that have experience with doing a lot of bolt-on deals.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You've got several examples here. I mean, give us an example from the feature and tell us how it's getting it right.
For example, this was a bit of a an odd one that I chose, but Staffline.
Okay.
You know, they're not necessarily, you know, the most highly acquisitive company, but obviously they're an outsourcer. So the next round of contracts that are being tendered next year, what they've done is they offer welfare to work programs. So they've made
more outsourcing. Ooh.
yeah. So they've acquired A4RE and they acquired Avanta, and they're trying to, because scale is so key, what they've done is made these big acquisitions. So they now are the largest provider at the moment, which means they've got a far greater chance of acquiring more work when the next round of tenders are put out. So that was just kind of like an example in a sector. Ian actually gave a very good example in his sector of Chesnara and Phoenix. I don't know if he just
tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, they're also a strange example, but being zombie life book consolidators, what they do is buy up kind of closed life business. And the reason that it's interesting to look at those at the moment, first, I mean, they're incredibly high dividend paying stock. They both pay about 6% dividend, but and which they pay for with these with the cash that is generated out of these books that they buy. So it's very important that these companies continue to buy to support that dividend. That's really the point of them as stocks. But Solvency II, which comes in January, a lot of the insurers have been forced to do a lot of work to get through that, as we've covered in the past, but also post the introduction of Solvency II, a lot of people are predicting more consolidation in that market. So more of these closed life insurance books will be up for sale. And these Phoenix especially is very hungry for more acquisitions, and so is Chesnara. And so they are, you know, look out for them trying to do deals next year, which will help them to grow grow their book and ultimately support that dividend.
Good, good stuff. We like a bit of income there.
Yeah.
I mean, you also give some examples of companies who've not gone about acquisitions
in the
right way.
Yeah, I don't think you could do an M&A feature without mentioning some of the horror stories. So I decided to kick it off with RBS.
Just to say,
obviously, you know, not to contradict, you know, we think this is M&A of the past.
Yeah, well, that's the mega deal gone bad.
The mega deal gone bad with AMB AMRO.
But then, you know, what we're saying is the bolt-on approach is not necessarily a panacea either. It's not the always going to deliver the goods if it's not done in the right way. And you give the example of what is now called Whatstone, but was formerly called Quindel.
Well, Quindel, I mean, I'm sure readers know a lot about Quindel, but obviously, yeah, that's a case study in a company which is making acquisitions. And I think, you know, really the growth actually isn't there. And a big thing that I wanted to reiterate, and maybe it sounds quite simple, but I think often there's a temptation to look at kind of revenue and operating profit and just use those as a measure of financial health, when really I think it needs to be rammed home a lot. And it might sound simple, but cash is king. I know that's a cliche, but it really is.
We all need reminding of that.
Cash and debt. Look at those. Like, it can't be said enough.
Because that was the big lesson with the banks, as we all know from the financial crisis, right? That these acquisitions, and you made the obvious example of RBS, they massively grow the balance sheet, you know, far stripping the amount of equity they have on the balance sheet. So when property market values fall, or where the values of some of those assets fall, there's less equity to cover it. So actually, in our banking coverage, we put in a leverage ratio, which is a bit of a crude measure, but it's to kind of look at that exact thing that you're talking about. What kind of risk is being built up on the balance sheet?
But in Quindel's case, it was
buying so many businesses. And actually, Philip Ryland, our associate editor, did a great piece. Actually, people should look it up. It's called The Quindel Conundrum.
It won an award.
It did win an award. And yeah, it's great. And it was about basically the real issue was the revenue recognition, and the fact that if you're buying so many companies and then you're then for those companies kind of booking the revenue long before the cash has come in,
yeah.
Which, I mean, I write about sports services, and there are a lot of companies that do this, but the fact is when you're growing so fast, the lag between booking revenue and the cash, the lag gets greater and greater. And this is one of the big problems with Quindel.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess the rest is history with that one. Needless to say, we don't advise investors buy that.
No. Well, it's a slightly different company now, but I haven't looked at it since.
Of course, it's Watchstone now. And I know they've got a new CEO and everything.
Indeed.
Who's definitely trying to... I was just reading through, obviously, the most recent trading statements. He's definitely trying to improve governance and things like that. So,
well, more welcome. Emma, thank you very much. It's a really interesting feature. When we've done acquisition M&A features in the past, we've always gone on the sort of who's going to get bought approach. And I think this is almost more interesting, because that's kind of speculative. This is really, really how to spot the acquirers, you know, companies that are good at this and can you know, keep acquiring without stretching themselves and keep the margins growing and the profits growing. Actually, yeah. It's a really good way to grow a business, complementing organic growth. So, have a look at this Merger Masters Tetris-based cover. Sure.
Yeah, I like that.
Yes, stroke of genius from the design studio there. We were bamboozled with this one. Okay, and that pretty much wraps up this week's podcast. Lots more in the issue, like I said, lots of results. John Barron is back this week. He's talking about his Japanese exposure. He's actually topping up there. He thinks that Abe's third arrow is starting to take effect, and that we could see a lot more strong returns to come from that market out there. He's particularly interested in the fact that Japanese companies are sitting on lots and lots of cash, so we might start seeing some dividend distributions increasing from there. Lots in the comments section, lots more in the news section, including a good piece from Alex on consolidation potential in the oil industry, talking of M&A. And Harriet's obviously written a bit in your feature about healthcare M&A,
which is mental. Towards the
$600 billion less, this year.
Kind of, yeah, less bolt-on, more massive deals. Yeah.
Well, we've had Pfizer Allergen announced. That's, what, $160 billion?
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling. Mm. And as I said, lots in the comments section. Dillo, Bearball, Simon Thompson and The Trader. Pick up the magazine. All good news agents. Merger Masters, £4.50. And I'll see you all again next week. Thanks, everybody.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.